Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 358 for Tuesday, October 11th, 2011. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in some questions. You share your tips. We do our best to give you some answers. We share some tips of our own. And together, we all try to learn a little something new about the Mac and perhaps other technology. Yep, here from Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
So, John, did you order a new iPhone 4S?
No.
Okay. I was just curious.
Well, I'll tell you why.
Yeah, go.
Well, I certainly could, but I would probably have to pay about $600.
Oh, right. Because your contract is still.
Right. My contract is up for renewal, or I can get a new device at the subsidized price, I believe, October 2012.
Okay.
So, and you know, honestly, I mean, the 4S, I like the 4. It does what I need. Sure. I thought the 4S feature, some of them were compelling, especially the camera. But
I agree.
And I think the other thing, though it's been a the potential for having it be a world phone also seems interesting. But the more I read, the more that I see that it's not as easy as that, that you don't necessarily have full capability on both CDMA and GSM. You're still kind of locked into whoever you're locked in with. Right. Or that's what I hear, is that you can't just, depending on who you're with, cause like, for example, I think they may not necessarily enable the GSM functionality, right, if you get it from CDMA, either Verizon or Sprint, who are both CDMA, right?
So correct. Yes.
So they may not enable the GSM, or I guess they call it locking, or the phone may be locked where it would be difficult without doing something after the fact. So, but those are the two, I think the two big things not that I travel much in GSM areas, but you know, if I do turn into a globetrotter, that would be a nice plus. So the answer in short is no, but I think, and by the time next year, they'll probably have another one.
I'm sure you're right. Well, actually I'm not sure. Right. Cause they went a little over a year with this one. So you never know, but yeah.
If I could have got, because the thing is, I looked at, you know, a number of people that will, I think Apple will buy back the phone and some other people will, and I could probably have gotten about $200.
That's right.
And that's what it would have cost me, because I probably would have gone for the same model that I got, which cost about $200. So it would have been a wash, but yeah, I'm not eligible. So.
Right. Right.
Now you got one, I guess. Now,
I handled it for the two of us, because I ordered two of them.
Oh, thank you.
Sure. Well, but I'm going to return one. So I wasn't entirely certain whether I wanted to stick with AT&T or move to Verizon. So I ordered two, and I figured I'd cancel one. But of course, by the time I made my decision that I would stick with AT&T, they were already both in, you know, some sort of processing limbo and couldn't be canceled. So I'll just refuse delivery on one, and it'll be simple.
Well, no, but don't you have with any of the phone companies, don't you have like a week or so within which you can return it with no penalty? I thought.
That's right.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Or you could just refuse it.
I don't need to go through that. Right. If I've already made the decision to stick with AT&T, or if I had made the decision to move to Verizon, there's no reason to set up both of them. But yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah. With Apple, you have 30 days to return it no matter what. No matter which carrier it is, as long as you've ordered it from Apple. Yeah.
So. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know why I was up at 3 a.m. I don't know why the other people were either. I mean, dude, well, it's a phone, but no, but there was the same problem. I think the people that did the best, I think Verizon's system did the best as far as handling the mobs.
Yeah,
I was reading reports that AT&T kept, you know, people kept getting screens that said, you know, your transaction failed, try again.
And really?
A lot of people were getting really frustrated. At least the people I saw on Twitter who were, you know, trying to get it right. I think 3 a.m. Eastern, I think, is when they opened 12, the floodgates.
Right, midnight Pacific is when they opened the floodgates.
Right. Yeah. Eventually, but no, the most reports I saw of issues were with trying to order an AT&T phone.
Oh,
and the least issues a Verizon phone.
Because
my experience with Verizon was good last time too. I think I, you know, like everybody else, you know, I think I waited a couple hours to let it die down. But my experience was it was still within the first few hours that they put it up, that they made it available. But no, it was, you know, this is going to happen. You know, you're going to get a dog pile of people
right
all at the same time. And can you scale? Well, who knows?
I didn't have any trouble. I did them about 6:30 Eastern when I woke up to get the kids up for school and all that. And both orders went right through. But yeah, in the end, cost wise, it's about the same, you know, for a service plan on one versus the other. And there are some areas where I go occasionally where AT&T has moderate service and Verizon is definitely the service winner. But with being able to keep my unlimited bandwidth, if I stick with AT&T and the faster speeds with AT&T, I mean, there's no question that 3G is faster on AT&T than Verizon.
Sure.
I figured, you know, that all else being equal, fine. I'll just stick with AT&T. It's simpler. So,
yeah. And, you know, I'm wondering about, and then we should get to the Mac Geek app, but, you know, I did see this. So of course, you know, per, request of, you know, the PMO staff, I researched, you know, could I get the unlimited data plan? And, apparently people are grandfathered just like AT&T, I think does with current customers.
Right.
If I was going to pay $650 for the phone,
right.
Which I didn't want to do, but then what they're offering, which doesn't seem so bad is, but they also offered on the same screen. I think it was 2, 5, and 10 gigabyte, data plans, which to me doesn't, I think the two, I believe it's gigabyte, right?
It is.
I think it's a 2 gigabyte plan. I look at my usage. And, you know, I'll use it if I'm out and about, but I don't think I've ever reached that much
per month.
So to me, that's it. Maybe there's some people. I mean, yeah, if you're streaming video or something. But I think for most people, I don't know if the data cap is a huge issue. At least I don't think it would be for me.
It wouldn't be based on past usage for you. What I noticed is as soon as I started testing any sort of photo uploading service, be it using, you know, the iFi card or testing, you know, iCloud or anything like that, bam, my bandwidth usage, because I sat at about 500K a month, you know, if I traveled maybe a gig. But as soon as I started testing anything where it was taking photos and uploading them, either manually or automatically, I suddenly was, you know, easily at a gig and a half, if not, you know, 2+. Regularly. And I'm not doing anything funny. I'm not, you know, I'm not tethering, you know, or anything like that. So it's just bandwidth used by the phone and it's pictures. So if I were to, you know, once we've got iOS 5 in the wild and everybody's got, you know, iPhoto in the cloud or iCloud or PhotoStream, I guess is what it's called, right? Where any picture you take on any of your devices is automatically shared with all of them. So you're not only going up from your phone, but back down with anything that you've put in your iPhoto, that will start to use a lot of bandwidth. And I think that to me, that was the reason to protect my unlimited bandwidth. So,
okay,
so we'll see. We'll see.
Because, you know, for the most part, I mean, most of the places I go, at least when I travel local, I'm almost always near Wi-Fi. So, of course, I'm using the Wi-Fi.
Sure.
Which doesn't
count against you. Right. Right.
Right. And of course, there's still the issue. I think I saw you asking some people and, you know, there's still that issue of the CDMA phones not being able to do both data and voice on the CDMA network
simultaneously.
But if you have Wi-Fi, then you can.
Yeah, you know what
and
was
the AT&T ads kind of, you know, I got to say they phrase it very cleverly is that they say, you know, they're not lying, but I think it's a little deceptive because the CDMA phones can do voice and data at the same time. It's just not both on the CDMA network. But if you have Wi-Fi and voice, then you certainly can do both. And then for the most part, I'm always near a Wi-Fi, either in my house or they have a Optimum Wi-Fi here in Fairfield and a lot of Connecticut, which is, you know, if you have Optimum online, you get free Wi-Fi and it's in a lot of areas. So I find that works for me.
So about half the people I asked about this, and this started with someone alerting me to it. I hadn't even thought about it this way, but about half the people I asked said on Verizon said, yes, they had experienced what they would consider a larger number than expected number of calls that went straight to voicemail as opposed to ringing first and then going to voicemail.
Really?
Yeah. And, wow. And
I've never had that. If I've been talking and another call came in, I would always see at least a notification saying, hey, there's another call. You want to switch over to it or would roll over.
Huh. Now, this isn't when people were talking on the phone. This is when the phone was seemingly otherwise doing nothing. And the presumed issue, and again, there's no way to truly confirm this, at least not from the data sample I got, but those who had experienced it, the presumed issue was that at the moment that the phone would have received the call, it was doing some sort of data connection in the background, be it, and this wasn't just iPhones on Verizon. I asked some friends with Droid phones. And again, some of them said never experienced it. Some of them said, oh yeah, I have. And it's, you know, the phone is doing some sort of background data connection, checking email, updating the weather, you know, Android phones actually do quite a bit in the background. And that was presumably what was causing at least some of these, you know, calls to route straight to voicemail. So I, you know, again, I don't know how much of an issue that would be, although I do receive a lot of calls and it would certainly be a drag if they started, you know, just routing to voicemail randomly, because that certainly is frustrating. And to be fair, I have experienced that with AT&T. I think everyone has at some point or another.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah.
So anyway, you know, while we're on this subject, I do want to talk about our first sponsor, which is Gazelle. Gazelle.com is a perfect place if you have ordered a new iPhone and want to get rid of your old one. John, you mentioned that Apple would give you $200 for a 32 gig iPhone 4. I just looked that up on Gazelle and it's easy. I just started typing iPhone 4 in and it let me pick that from a list. Gazelle says that for a good phone, which is neither broken nor flawless, they say that 90% of the phones that they get are in the condition they call good. They'd pay you $201 and they'll give you cash. Whoa. It's not a credit. It's not anything. It's just, you know, here you go. They'll give you.
Oh, right. Apple's is a gift card, right?
Towards Apple stuff. Mm. Right. So with Gazelle, you can do a check, which they'll mail right to you. PayPal, which they'll put in your account. Or if you're willing to accept an Amazon gift card, they'll give you an extra 5%. On top of the whatever they've nice. Decided it's worth. Yeah. So check it out. Gazelle.com. And it's not just iPhones. It's anything electronic. Type it in and see what they give you. And they'll lock your price in for 30 days. So my guess is that we'll see. I would assume we'll start to see a decline in used values of iPhone 4s as, you know, new ones come out. So, you know, as the new ones hit the street. So. Lock your price in today, gazelle.com, and then you can, you know, send it off once you got your new one. All right. Now,
you know, that does lead me to a question, though.
Yeah,
Dave.
Go ahead, John.
Now, if I'm going to take any device that I have and give it, you know, sell it to someone, whether it be Gazelle, which sounds like a great deal or something, you know, I'm trying to remember this, but I think you'd want to probably clear the data off the device. I don't know if they're going to do that for you. And, you know, I'm trying to think. I think I've dug into that and I'm not sure where that is exactly. Maybe you know off the top of your head or we can.
So the Gazelle will clear the data off before they do anything with it.
Oh,
but
sweet.
But that said, I think it's a very prudent move to do it yourself. Right. And the way I would do it would be to just do a restore of the operating system onto the phone. Now you can do it.
Oh wait, no, I just found it here. So
there
so
is
I have
a way
my phone
to do it on
me.
The phone too. Right. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Walk through the steps, John. Go ahead.
Settings. General. Oh, where is it? It was here. Reset. And then the bottom menu is reset. There we go. And then it has reset all settings, erase all content and settings. I think that's probably, oh, and there's some others here. Reset network settings. That may be good for diagnosing network problems. Reset keyboard dictionary. Oh, look at, you know, I've never been on the screen before. I just found it. Reset home screen layout and reset location warnings. Nice. Okay. So it sounds like erase all content and settings is what you would want to do before you send your phone. You sell your phone to anybody.
To anyone. Yeah. I think that's a safe bet. Yeah. But Gazelle will wipe it before they do anything with it. But still, it doesn't matter to be safe. You know, you're not just handing it directly to Gazelle. You're sending it through the FedEx or somebody. So yeah, definitely.
Okay.
All right.
Back to the Mac.
That's right. It's back to the Mac. That's good. Okay. So Ben has this is actually a great question because it's a nice little transition. He says, my old iMac stopped working, so I have another on order, and I will have a copy of the hard drive from the old machine. I'm doing a manual migration and want to know what files are necessary to copy over to keep my iPod Touch and Shuffle from having to start from scratch. I want those devices to think nothing ever changed. The new iMac has Lion. The old iMac G5 has Tiger. What do I do? Okay. And he says he had iTunes potentially 10.1 on that machine, but that should be okay. So we actually had several people asking this exact same question. And we heard back from several of you that this little bit of advice works. And the advice is just copy your home music iTunes folder to the same place on the new drive. And do that before you launch iTunes and before you connect your device to the machine. Do that. iTunes will update the library if necessary, if it's from an older version. And then you'll be fine. You'll be able to sync with your stuff and it'll see the same library, and your devices won't force you to go through any sort of reset or anything. So it's just if you go into your home folder, go into the music folder, there is an iTunes folder there. Copy that over and replace entirely the contents of that folder on your new machine. Make sure before you replace anything in its entirety that you haven't put anything out there. Now, presumably if you haven't launched it yet, you haven't put anything there. So there's nothing of value to delete. There will be stuff out there because that's how the iTunes folder is kind of set up out of the gate, but it's not going to have, it's not going to have your music or anything there. So just copy it in and that should do it. It's a pretty straight shot.
Really?
Yep.
Wow, that sounds almost too easy.
That's why we love this stuff, John.
Because, the thing is, though, I look at this, and when you look at the files in that folder, not only do you see things that contain your music and your artwork and stuff, but you also see, like, I think the key one here is iTunes Music Library.xml. I think that's pretty similar to what otherwise would be something in your preferences folder, right. A plist file. So it's nice that everything is self-contained, and it'd be nice if more apps do that. And I guess they're moving in that direction, well, where it's right. Not all scattered about, but it's all in one folder, which, you know, is the right way to do it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
All right. Moving on to Mike. Mike has a two-part question. We'll start with the first one. Mike says, I use an external hard drive for my Time Machine backups, which I plugged into the USB port of a new MacBook Air running a Lion. Once the Time Machine finishes, the Air goes to sleep. Unfortunately, whenever I wake that same Air back up, I get a warning window saying that the external hard drive was not properly ejected before shutting down. I'm afraid that the external hard drive directory is going to be damaged one of these times and no longer mount as a result. Is this a bug in Lion that the computer doesn't properly eject the external hard drive before it goes to sleep? Is there a way to avoid this situation? And then part two of the question is, I decided to adjust my energy settings and system preferences on my MacBook Air and tell the computer to never go to sleep. In there, I see there's an option, put the hard disk to sleep when possible. This leads me to ask, what does it mean when a solid state drive goes to sleep? Does an SSD even need to be put to sleep like a regular hard drive would? Okay, so let's answer question number two first, because that's a pretty straightforward answer, and then we'll get into some of the nuances that might be causing what you've talked about in number one. So about putting an SSD to sleep, John, I think you have some insight on this.
I got a theory.
Okay,
how's that?
All right, go. Sure.
Well, no. So what's happening? So putting a drive to sleep, what does that mean? And I think what it really means is that the OS at some point tells the drive, all right, you know what? I haven't talked to you for a while. Why don't you go into a, excuse me. Why don't you go into a low power mode until I need to talk to you again. Now on a rotational hard drive, what this typically involves is telling the drive, hey, spin down your motor, because that is the thing that draws the most juice. The drive is still there. It still knows that the world is there. But the motor, I think, is typically in a rotational drive, the thing that consumes the most juice. So that's what happens, is that a sleep signal gets sent to the drive and it's like, okay, well, and it may do some other things. It may power down some other electronics that are normally needed for running the drive. My understanding is that SSDs will do something similar. Of course, the SSD doesn't have a motor. So I think it isn't as much of a benefit in that you're putting it, because it's all chips, you're putting it in a low power state. I mean, you can certainly tell parts of the drive in an SSD, okay, you know, I don't really need you, or just go into this low power state because I don't really need to talk to you for a while. So so I'd say there's no downside to it. And of course, the thing is, as we've heard from others, and actually we had this question come up before, the problem with the rotational drive is when you wake it up, you got to wait for the motor to spin up, or at least the finder forces that, where, of course, on an SSD, I mean, you're talking almost instant startup. So I don't see any downside to selecting that. If anything, it'll save your, I mean, the SSDs already, depending on the one you get, already save a lot of juice. So this will save you more juice. Well, because I've seen some, like the one I'm looking at now, did advertise idle mode that has a certain power consumption. Now, I think I know what you're going to say, but yeah, depending on the SSD. Now, I've seen some SSDs where the power consumption in watts is on par with a mechanical drive, but I've seen some others where it is quite a bit lower. So it depends on the SSD. But again, I don't think there's any downside to selecting this, and I think the drives try to mirror as closely as possible the responding to that call. I'm going to assume that it's a SATA command that basically tells the drive, all right, sleep.
Yeah.
And it does whatever it feels appropriate.
I think that's right. Yeah. All right. So now, as for these backups, in a nutshell, and to paraphrase my dear friend John Braun here, that shouldn't happen.
Well, that was my wisdom in the pre-show. I'm like, I know. That's wrong. But yep. Then I started thinking, well, I'll let you lead, but I'm starting to try to think why it would be doing this. But give me your guess.
Yeah. So my feeling is that when the system goes to sleep, something is causing USB power goes away. Right. And if this is a USB powered drive, then it has no way of maintaining its state if the system is actually killing power to the USB bus, which my guess is it is when it goes to sleep. So now this drive is coming right back up, and perhaps it kills power to the USB bus as it's shutting down. So the system actually sees the drive go offline before before Mac OS X goes to sleep. And if that's the case, then when you turn it back on, the system reapplies power to the USB bus. This drive wakes up, says, hey, I'm here. And then you get this message saying, OK, look, the drive went offline unexpectedly, but it would have been expected, of course, because power was removed from the bus. So I think that's what's going on. Now, it may be I need to test this, frankly, with USB drives on the MacBook Air. But it may be a function of the way the Air deals with the drives. And if so, then it's what I've described. Otherwise, it could be a function of this drive pulling itself offline when it sees a low power condition, as opposed to just maintaining its state, if that were even possible. So that's I think it's kind of a function of dealing with a bus powered drive on a portable, that's going to go to sleep into a very low power mode and not provide any power out the USB bus.
I don't buy it.
All right.
Because I've had external drives, either USB or FireWire, and if I put a machine to sleep and I wake it up, I don't get that error message. So I'm going to take a guess here, especially being a software type of guy here, I'm going to blame the hardware. I'm wondering if it's a power consumption issue with the particular enclosure that is being used, or a bug in the enclosure. Now, he didn't mention the specific drive here.
Right. Right.
He just said it's an external USB drive. So I'm wondering if it's a power issue and that the thing is on the verge of drawing too much juice that the air could provide. Be providing.
We have the technology. I'm going to go ahead and put the show on pause here. The rest of you won't know that I've put it on pause, but I'm going to do that and go get the MacBook Air. And then we're going to do this live demo right here. and answer this at least with a drive that I have available. How's that sound to you, John?
Exciting.
All right. Okay, I'm back, but we need to plug stuff in here. So we need, we're going to need filler music. All right, so here we go. Okay. So we'll wake up the MacBook Air. That's right. I think we'll wake up the MacBook Air. This could take longer than I thought, John. Oh, there it is. Okay. I've got a USB drive here. Of course, I haven't woken up the MacBook Air in several days. So. All right. All right. Now, I have a I have a USB cable, and I've plugged the USB cable into the MacBook Air, and I'm plugging the USB cable into the hard drive, and the hard drive has a light that comes on it, which is good. It means that it, in theory, should allow it to be bus powered. Okay, so the drive has been mounted. So now, John, the moment of truth. I'm going to power down the MacBook Air. And we'll let it go to sleep. Now, there is no battery power. There is no external power being applied to this. Now, here's something interesting. So the MacBook Air is closed, presumably asleep. The hard drive still has its red light on, which means that USB power is being provided despite the fact that the MacBook Air is asleep. So now I'm going to wake it back up. The MacBook Air was definitely asleep. It's now awake again. And the drive is still connected and happy. So,
and I duplicated this. So while you were running away getting your machine, I actually ran downstairs and I got one of my USB drives. Although I indicated that, you know, I'm sure I've done this. I just wanted to double check.
Sure.
And I experienced the same thing you did. So I got one of these very nice OWC external enclosures, very basic one, USB 2.
Yep.
But I noticed the same thing. I closed the lid. Eventually, the light started pulsing, but the light on the drive stayed on, indicating, yep, as you pointed out, yes, it is getting power. So sleep, and apparently there's no bug that, yeah, cuts, because the only reason this would happen is if somehow you cut power to the drive, right? And you never saw that.
Right, right. That's right.
So again, that's why I'm going to blame the hardware still. I'm wondering if the drive, I don't know, I just still feel it's a power issue. If there's some way, so this, if this is a drive that you can yank and put in another enclosure, you may want to try that.
I tend to agree with my good friend, Mr. Braun here.
It happens. But I wouldn't blame the OS, because the test I just did is, so I did the test on my Lion machine. So as far as Mike's speculation that's bugging Lion, I do not believe that is the case.
No, I don't think so. Because it would have, I thought maybe it was something about the MacBook Air and them trying to make it, you know, super low power, but clearly that's not the case, because I'm running 10.7.1, the latest release of Lion, although I think in the next 24 hours we're going to see 10.7.2 because iCloud and all that is coming. But for now I'm running 10.7.1 on that machine because that's what's been released. And it behaved exactly as you heard. So,
you know, and the other thing too is that I see some hard drives, and I cringe when I see this. I've seen this very rarely, but some hard drives want you to install extra garbage when you get them. And I'm wondering if so it could be either drive firmware or power issue, or it could be some lame software that they installed on your machine that is doing something stupid. So
could be. All right, let's move on to Ralph. Ralph writes a question about antivirus protection on the Mac. Conventional wisdom suggests that there is no need to run antivirus software on Mac OS X yet. What about when running Windows on a Mac? In my case, I run Windows XP using Parallel 7 in order to run my one and only remnant of 20-something years using Windows, Microsoft Money. This is the only application I use while in Windows. I run it once a month, a quick in and out. No other apps programs run while in Windows. Parallels does support loading Kaspersky. Yeah, I think that's right. Is this necessary? All right. So my feeling on this is I agree with you. that while we did see a slight scare last year, in that there was, it wasn't a virus, it was more of a malware thing that came out for the Mac. I still am of the opinion that that you do not need virus protection software on the Mac yet. It will be interesting to see if that is simply a matter of time, though. But for now, that's right. As far as the Windows side, you're always running a risk because Windows is very susceptible to viruses. However, if you're not going online with your Windows installation, and if you're not downloading things and you're not visiting websites, then the chances of you contracting a Windows virus are extremely thin. So I would say you can likely live without it. But if you're using it to go online in any capacity, go ahead and install the Parallels. I mean, it comes with Kaspersky, so just let it install it and be safe. You're running your personal finances, presumably by using MS Money. My feeling is, you know, on the Windows side, let me put it this way. If you were going to set up a Windows machine and use it, there's no way you could live without virus protection. So I would treat your Parallels installation the same way. And the same goes for VMware and Bootcamp. If you're going to get online with them at all, or have them connected to the internet in any capacity, go ahead and do it. In your case, you probably don't need it, but I don't know that you want to run that risk with the probably. That's my feeling. Mr. Braun?
Yes. Where are you going? You sounded far away.
I was leaving me. I'm still here.
Don't leave me. I concur, because, you know, having worked with Windows on almost a daily basis, especially the older versions, even though they still keep patching it. Yes. If and, you know, you said the same thing I was thinking. If the machine is connected in any way, shape or form to any sort of network, then yes, get virus protection. If it's not, if you're not going to surf with it, like you said, so I back you up on this. If you're not going to surf and you're not going to be on a network and networking with anyone outside of your local home network, then I would say you probably don't need to. But I would anyways. Like, for example, what I do is, so I'm running, I got to look at the latest version Parallels, which I understand is the cat's meow.
Yeah.
You know, it's really nice. But actually, right now really I'm running right now I'm running VMware. Yeah. And I actually met with them. And you know, I keep seeing these guys leapfrog each other. You know, Parallels comes up with some innovations, then VMware does. And then, you know, they kind of go back and forth. I see those are the two big dogs.
Lately,
I think,
though, that hasn't been happening. Parallels has
been taking a couple of leaps.
In my opinion, yeah, Parallels is certainly the smoother one to use. It's the smoother one to install all the virtual machines into. I mean, they've really focused nicely on it. That doesn't mean VMware won't come back. They're certainly worth paying attention to. They've been around.
It works. Hey, it does what I need. Time. It runs. And I'm still doing Windows XP.
Okay. Yeah.
Or at least, you know, I have a development environment set up. So, you know, I run Visual Studio. I have XP. They still have, you know, the security updates and all that. But VMware does what I need. But what I do, so if you didn't have, I wasn't aware that Parallels actually gives you antivirus. But the one that I use is an open source thing called Clam AV antivirus.
Okay. Yep.
And it's an open source antivirus program. And that's what I have installed on my VMware. But yeah, install something. Again, if you're on a network, there are viruses, you know, which I think technically the, you know, definition is a virus is something that can propagate over a network.
Yeah, but you also want to protect against spyware and all that stuff, too. And most of these programs
protect
against that. Try out it. I haven't tried Clam AV, but AVG makes a good free one.
No,
if you don't have one that came with your virtualization environment, which, again, Parallels definitely does include that. So,
okay.
All right. So, our second sponsor for this show is Barebones Software at barebones.com with BB Edit 10. Actually, it's up to 10.1, but the number that's most important to you is the price and the date, actually. So between now and October 20th, which isn't that far away, you can get BB Edit 10 for $39.99 US. That's not an upgrade price. That's not anything special other than a time limited offer for everyone. So $39.99. After that, It only goes up $10 to $49.99, which is still way less than half of what it used to cost. This is the deal of the century. And I think it's a smart move for Bare Bones, but we're not here to editorialize. We're here to run their spot. $39.99 for BB Edit 10. BB Edit is the product that launched the company. They have the whole text editing environment down to a science here. So sure, if you just want to edit text, it's great. And it'll sort text. It'll count lines. It'll count words. It'll count all the characters, all that good stuff. But where it really begins to shine is when you start managing projects. Now, those projects can really be anything, but it's really cool because you can start doing, you can take a group of text files and do a multi-file find and replace on all of them at once and have it show you the changes before you commit them or not. You can manage files on an FTP server just as though they are local. So you can open a file from a remote server, edit it, and when you hit save, it's saving it back out to that remote server without any great fanfare to you. It just does its thing. Additionally, if you're editing any kind of code, meaning HTML or Java or JavaScript or C++ or really anything, I haven't found one that it won't do. It starts coloring, not in the code itself, but on the screen in BB Edit, it starts coloring and highlighting that code, allowing you to format things, allowing you to see things a whole lot easier. Functions are separated out. It creates this whole beautifully rich, interactive programming environment. And it's really fantastic. And if you haven't checked it out, it's worth your shot. There is a free trial that you can download from barebones.com. Just make sure you buy it before October 20th. Otherwise, there's a $10 tax. So it's $39.99 now, $49.99 after October 20th. So check it all out at barebones.com.
No, I dig them. I use them to lovingly handcraft the show notes, Dave. That is my program of choice to do that. And also I noticed that in one of the menus here,
yeah,
they support CVS, which we were talking about versioning a little while ago. That's right. One of the more popular. So that's, yeah, I mean, it does it all.
It does. All right, let's go to Brad here, John. Brad says, I have a 2011 okay. MacBook Pro that keeps asking me to allow incoming connections every time I start up iTunes. If I click on allow, it will still ask me the next time I start up iTunes again. I have it set to allow in the firewall, but the message keeps returning. I do have an Apple TV 2 on the same network, so I'm not sure if this is causing any problems. I get the message rather the Apple TV 2 is on or off. I did an upgrade to Lion, so I'm not sure if this has anything to do with it since it wasn't a clean install. I cannot remember if it started as soon as I did the Lion upgrade or not. So, John, we've talked about this before and we've experienced this before. I seem to remember that this has to do with code signing. And if the system.
Yes.
OK, if the system believes an app is not code signed, it will not maintain its the firewall settings will not persist from launch to launch. But I think there's an easy solution. And I'll let you take it from here because I think
I want to let's try to describe without getting into a tutorial about encryption and all that code signing. What is code signing?
Sure. And we've been through this before, but it's worth a quick
refresher. Well, I want to revisit it. So code. So number one, we're going to talk code. What is code? Well, code is your software on your computer. Now, what is signing? And that's where we're going to try. You know, I think we usually do a good job of this because there is so much mathematics and all that involved in this. But I think basically code signing. So the first step in this whole process is that you got to get something called a digital certificate. Now, it's really just a bunch of numbers. But what it does, what's important is the process behind it. And this is the key to the whole infrastructure where if you go to a website and you type in HTTPS for a secure connection, there's a digital certificate behind it. And this is the same technology that is used with code signing. Now, what is a digital certificate? And trying to describe it and help me out here, David, I'm going to try to formulate it. Your Mac has a list of entities that it trusts. People that issue these digital certificates, which is really just a process where you apply for one of these and they check you out. They check your identification. They make sure you're legitimate. And if you pass their test, you're issued a digital certificate. And suffice to say that the digital certificate you're given, whether it's from Apple or VeriSign or any of the other big players, if you have one of these and you've passed their test, there is a counterpart within the operating system that matches the certificate. And normally what will happen is that if there's no problem, the computer will say nothing. But if there's a problem between the certificate and what's in the operating system, as far as its listed certificates, it's going to say, whoa, 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 either, you know, the dates don't match or the name is wrong, or this thing called a digital signature just doesn't match. And what happens is that if you're given a digital certificate, hopefully from somebody that has a thorough process of making sure you are who you say you are, then you won't see any problem. But if this test fails, or this little bit of data called a digital signature is either missing or corrupted, then what's going to happen is what you're going to see happening with the firewall. Now, hopefully that was somewhat in English there, Dave.
Yeah. So if I can crystallize this, what
please.
Yeah.
I like that. I like crystals too.
Good. So app developers get a special piece of code that they can bake into their application that lets the operating system know that this app was created by the person who says they created it.
Good.
Okay. So what's happening here is, as you said, John, and far more verbosely, what's happening here is the OS is saying, I don't trust that you were created by the entity that you say you were created by. And therefore, a lot of these extra things that we're going to do with apps that we trust don't apply to you. But what's weird here is this is iTunes and it's an Apple operating system. So something has just gone wrong. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the solution is to simply reinstall iTunes. And I believe in the past when we've seen this, that has solved this issue.
Right. And I think the root of this issue. So number one, what setting on the computer is bringing up this warning? You may be asking yourself, Dave.
Oh, is there a setting that you can affect? Oh,
There is.
OK,
so you go into System Preferences, Security, Firewall, and then you click on Advanced. And there is a checkbox saying automatically allow signed software to receive incoming connections. Now, what you're also going to see in that list is a bunch of applications. Excuse me, that have should have gotten more tea. All right. Or water. Sorry. But you're going to also see a list of applications that I assume are signed applications. And in the firewall app, and you're probably following along with me here, Dave.
I'm you're not gonna see, because I don't have the firewall on, but go ahead. And I certainly don't want to turn it on while we're recording this show over Skype.
It's fine. But if you go to the system preference, so again, you go to the system preference, firewall, security, firewall, advanced, you're going to see a list of applications.
Right.
What you should see. Now, here's the other reason that this may happen is that in the, so you're going to see a list of applications, and to the right, you're going to see a setting. Now, normally it should say allow incoming connections,
which is what it says for Brad on iTunes, but it won't.
Right.
Still won't let him because it's lost this signing. But
right.
But again, reinstalling will fix that.
Yeah. Right. And the problem is, and I believe what happened is at one point when Apple released an incremental update that you do through software update, they screwed up applying the signature. And so all of a sudden everybody got this, and yeah, I'm with you, Dave. Yeah. I had this problem too, and I had to erase, you know, maybe you want to erase with a app deleter just to make sure you get rid of all the pieces. But I don't think I did that. I just downloaded iTunes, the iTunes installer from Apple, reinstalled it, and then everything was groovy. Now, a little minor tangent here is that I ran into this also. I was in the same control pit or never going to stop saying it, system preference pane. And the thing was, so you and I, Dave, both are, happy new Drobo owners. And I noticed something really weird with the Drobo app. So Drobo has something called their Drobo dashboard. And so I ran it and it came up and it said, I can't find, any Drobos. And I'm like, well, that's funny because it's plugged in. Then I looked, and they actually had a tip on their site, but I figured it out myself before I went to their site. But they actually have a process called DD service. 64D, I think, in my list here. And for whatever silly reason, it was set to deny incoming connections. So I'm like, why isn't it seeing the drive? I just installed it. I just plugged it in. And actually, and there were a couple of other apps, which was kind of weird. So you may want to look at, if you have any network-based applications and you have the firewall on and they're not working right, you may want to just go to this advanced tab and just look at the list of apps and just make sure they're all, they all have a little green dot and say allow incoming connections. I was actually surprised that I had a couple of things that were marked as red saying deny incoming connections. And I have no idea why, but apparently for whatever reason, DDSer, the Drobo background daemon comes in listed as deny. I don't know why. So thought I'd share that because kind of freaked me out.
Oh yeah. I was going to say it didn't for me, but I don't have the firewall on. It could also be that you click.
You don't have the firewall on?
No.
What, are you crazy?
No, I don't. Well, possibly, but I don't think that's evidence of it.
Why don't you have the, I'm curious. You don't have the firewall on?
No, none of my Macs here at the house. No.
Really?
Why would I?
Why wouldn't you?
I sit behind a router that I trust. And
okay, all right. So you're saying, so you're counting on your router to block any evildoers.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And by nature right, of
I,
what
I
it,
guess I'm with you on that.
By nature
you
of
got,
what
you it, got a big boy router. You don't have like a airport or something.
Yeah, but even if I had an airport, I mean, by nature of what it does, it doesn't just pass packets through willy nilly. It can't. It doesn't know what to do with unsolicited packets, so it just ignores them. And this is true of every router out there that you're using with your single IP address, cable modem or DSL. Because it's taking one IP address and sharing it, it can't do anything with packets that are coming in unsolicited. It just ignores them unless you've got port forwarding set up for it to do those.
Right.
Things.
Okay. So that was my thought. But I'm still wondering if somebody crafts an attack that does a broadcast. Okay.
It has yet to bite me. When I travel, like on my MacBook Air, I'll flip the firewall on, and I do that when I turn all my sharing stuff off.
Oh, especially if we're on like a trade show or a hotel network. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But otherwise, no, I just leave it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I don't, they get in the way. I don't
know.
Well, yeah.
Well, you know, I gotta say, I tend to agree with you because especially when I've done work with Windows networking in an enterprise situation, a lot of times there, for whatever stupid reason, the Windows firewall would get in the way, even though you explicitly try to share a drive.
Yeah.
You couldn't connect to it. And the solution was either to type in the IP address manually and the port and all that, or the advice was, we'll disable the firewall. Then you can connect to this machine.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. No, I'm curious. I keep it on. Just maybe I should turn it over. But I haven't had it cause any problems. So I guess that's why I leave it on. Except for this one problem you talked about, or that we're talking about now.
Yeah.
Is that all of a sudden this one app came up as deny incoming connections. Actually, I think I saw it in the console initially.
Yeah.
It was like DD service, whatever. Connection denied. And I'm like, well, why is it denied? And then I finally drilled into the firewall setting.
Yeah, but is it denied automatically, or did you just hit deny the first time the firewall asked you about it?
Oh, no. After I installed, so when you get the Drobo, you get the software, or you download it from their site. And as soon as I installed their, what they call their Drobo dashboard, I ran it, and it's like, oh, well, yeah, I can't see any Drobos. And I'm like, okay, well, that's kind of weird.
Yeah, that is.
And no, and I looked in the console and I think I saw a message explicitly saying, attempt to connect to port, whatever, via DD service, the thing I mentioned. And it was like connection denied. And I'm like, well, why is it being denied? So again, if you have the firewall on, go to the advanced button, check all your settings and make sure that everything is set the way you want it. To me, they should all the apps listed should be green. Allow incoming connections unless you have a specific reason to block it.
Right. Right. All right. All right. Let's wrap up questions with this one from Everett. And then we've got some tips to go on to.
Hi, I have a quick question about iTunes and I'm having an issue with it. When I go to drag some, either one media file onto iTunes or even multiples or a folder of it, it tells me attempting to copy to the disk Macintosh HD failed. You do not have enough access privileges for this operation. and it won't let me put it onto the desktop either. So, and this is off of a thumb drive. So, all right. Thanks.
Sure. You bet. So this doesn't sound like an iTunes issue, simply because you said you can't copy from the thumb drive to the desktop either. My feeling is that it's, in the best case, it's a permissions issue with the thumb drive itself. And in the worst case, it's a corruption issue with data on the thumb drive itself. And so there's a couple things I'd try. The first thing I'd try, John, would be to I'd click on the thumb drive in the Finder, do a get info, and see if it is set to ignore permissions on that volume. And if it's not, I would check that right. box, right? Because then, you know, now these permission things are gone. If that doesn't do it, the next thing I'd do is I'd run disk utility and choose verify disk on that thumb drive and hope that there's just something wrong with the file structure that's got that going. But yeah, because you shouldn't be getting those kinds of errors when copying from the thumb drive, unless you've got a read permission set on that in a very weird way on that thing. So those are, I can't think of anything else. Do you have anything on that one, John?
Nope. You covered it. Yeah. You should never see that message. Well, yeah. Of course, that's why he's writing us.
That's why we're here. That's right.
But I would think it's the permissions issue. I think is the most likely cause here, or corruption. No, yeah. I'm with you. You got it. I think.
Okay, so we have a couple of follow-ups. Well, not from the very last show, because 357 didn't have any questions or tech stuff, of course. It was our memories of Steve Jobs, if you will. And if you haven't heard it, you can go back and listen. But from our last regular show, number 356, we had a couple of follow-ups, and we will go through a couple of them now. Tony shared something very interesting. We were talking about secure delete and all of that good stuff. And Tony writes, John and Dave, there is a keyboard shortcut for secure empty trash. It is Shift Command Delete, but be careful when using it. And of course he's right, because it does exactly what it says it will do, but you aren't actually reading the text secure delete. You're just telling it to do it with the, by holding Shift and Command. Yeah.
Now that's a fish shake, because why doesn't it appear in the Finder menu? Unless it's so dangerous that they decided to hide it. Maybe that's the reason. Okay.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right? I mean, to me, it's just good UI practice that if you have a keyboard shortcut for something, it should appear in the menu. It does for pretty much anything, right?
Is that correct?
I would.
Yeah. It is.
Again,
correct.
Attention to detail to me. Hey.
Yeah.
Again, it could be an exception that it's so.
No, this isn't. No, wait a minute. Tony's wrong. At least for what? me and Snow Leopard. So I hold down Shift Command Delete and, I did the wrong one. But that's okay. So if I hold down Shift Command Delete in the Finder, I get. Are you sure you want to permanently erase the items in the trash? However, if I go to the Finder menu and choose Secure Empty Trash, I get a different dialogue telling me about Secure Empty Trash. So Shift Command Delete will empty the trash, but I do not believe that is doing a Secure Empty Trash. Unless you've got something else there, John, I think that's right. So, live demos, testing these things, folks, for you. That's what we do. So that, yeah, shift command delete will empty the trash, but
do we?
It's not a secure empty trash. Are you on Lion testing this? Because I'm testing it on Snow Leopard, which is.
Oh, no, I'm looking under Snow Leopard. I'm looking at the. So I found a wonderful article, HT1343, Mac OS X keyboard shortcuts, which is dated October 5th, 2011. And I do not see one for. Secure.
All right. Moving on to Randy with a follow-up from show 356. A little something that we addressed during the show about ejecting disks, but then a little something more on top of that.
Hi, Dave and John. This is Randy in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm just listening to the episode where you're talking about mounting drives and also with Super Duper. And one item, I'm not sure if you were aware or not, but if you set up a scheduled backup recurring with Super Duper, you don't have to tell it to unmount the drive afterwards. Super Duper is smart enough that if the drive is unmounted but connected to the computer, it will automatically mount it for the backup job or the cloning job. And then when it's finished, it will put it back in the state that it was in before, which in this example would be unmounted. So it's actually kind of automatic. All you have to do is mount the drive in order to set up your clone, schedule it, unmount it, and then Super Duper will keep it that way going forward, which is pretty handy. On a separate item, while you can mount and unmount disks easily with, with disk utility, if people are users of iStat menu, that actually makes it incredibly fast because you probably have a little icon in your menu bar for the drive capacity. And if you simply click that.
Uh-oh. What happened there, Randy?
Click that.
There we are.
Among all the information that it shows you is your unmounted drives. And if you just click on that unmounted drive, it will actually mount it for you. Thanks for a great show. Appreciate it. Bye.
Thanks very kindly, Randy. That's good advice. I'd forgotten about iStat menus mounting disks. That's handy advice. All right. And one last tip from David. He writes, quick Lion tip in case it helps. I just did a clean install of Lion after making a bootable USB Lion disk, but I did migrate a few things with Migration Assistant. I think all I did with my desktop, docs, music, etc. I definitely did not import settings, library, applications. Anyway, what was really weird to me is that a couple of apps I had downloaded from the Mac App Store before the upgrade were showing up as though they were already installed on my new install of Lion. No matter what I did, I could not find them. Even more odd, one of them had an update available, so I tried to update, and it would give me an error saying I needed to log into a different Apple ID to download, and I know I've only ever used one. Well, after a few hours of frustration, I finally found the issue and I wanted to share it with you and your listeners. I don't know why, but because I'm a geek and because you listen to this show and you've learned how to troubleshoot, I just spent 30 minutes going through each and every menu and system preferences in detail just to see what was new. Well, when I went to users and groups login items, lo and behold, those missing programs were set to launch on startup. I simply removed them from this list, relaunched the App Store, and now was able to successfully download and install them with no problem at all. I hope this might help any other Lion upgraders that listen. So what happened was with Migration Assistant, he pulled over some of his settings, and one of those settings was his login items, which got pulled in with his account. And it was pointing to things that didn't exist, but for whatever reason, the App Store saw these pointers and it got into this funky state that David described. So kudos to you, David, for finding that. That's awesome. And thanks for sharing it, because I'm sure one of us is going to run into this if we haven't already. So good stuff. Anything to add before we go through? I think we've got one cool stuff found that I stumbled on this week, speaking of the Mac App Store, but do you have anything else, John, before we do
you
that?
Go.
Okay. So I did find this thing called Cursor Finder at cursorfinder.com. You can buy it from the Mac App Store for 99 cents. And what it does is it allows you to either center your cursor or have the system put a spotlight on it. So if you've got multiple monitors, you've got keystrokes, shortcut keys that will either snap your cursor back to the center of the screen or put a big highlight on it. So cool stuff. That's why we do what we do. So cool stuff found, 99 cents at the Mac App Store Cursor Finder. And John, I think that gets us to where we need to bring the real band in again. Well, not the real band, but the normal band, which used to be a real band. All right.
Where do we start?
Well, we start with the end. It's like having dessert as an appetizer. Wait, no, that's not it at all.
Well, sometimes you may want to cleanse your palate with something sweet, right?
Like a sorbet.
I think I've heard of that.
Yeah, sure.
If you want to cleanse your palate or just get in touch with us, Dave, you know what I'd do? I would send us an email. And you know, I'm going to tell you where I'm going to send it. I'm going to send it to feedback@mattkeekab.com.
Well, I think the right place to send it would be feedback@mattkeekab.com.
I agree with you in all respects, except it really should be feedback@mattkeekab.com.
Or, of course, premium@mattkeekab.com if you are one of our glorious premium members. And thank you.
What is premium, Dave? I have not heard of this.
So premium is something we started almost 2 years ago.
Isn't that long? Really?
Yeah, wow. I think so. Yeah. We do an extra 2 episodes a month. And those are available only to our premium subscribers. In addition to those 2 episodes, premium subscribers can have access to this special email address and also full access to the Mac Geek Gab archives. But the main reason that we started the premium show was because many of you simply wanted to reach out and support John and I. And that was sort of the catalyst for this, but we wanted to give you something in return.
And you wanted more.
More.
And we're giving you more.
That's right. So it's $25 for a 6-month subscription to get all of that. And that's what premium is. So, John, you mentioned cleansing the palate. If you want to use your palate and communicate your message verbally, you could call us at 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is
4335.
That it is. You can visit the show notes at MacGeekGab.com, and you can see us on Facebook at Facebook.com/MacGeekGab. Go over there, give us a like,
Wow. Send
us a question. Good stuff.
We haven't mentioned for a while iTunes comments.
Love
those. If you have a comment, positive. Well, no, only positive.
I don't know. You can say whatever you want over there.
Yeah, constructive criticism is always welcome. Not in this case, but. But no, iTunes comments, please. Comment on the podcast. Tell other people what you think, why you listen to us, or why you don't. Though, if you don't listen to us, then you won't be hearing this message. So.
That's right.
Whatever.
Twitter.com. You can find him at John F. Braun. You can find me at Dave Hamilton. You can find Pilot Pete at Pilot Pete, since that's the only place he seems to be found these days.
Where is he?
He's flying. He's piloting.
Well,
you can follow the podcast at Twitter.com/MacGeekGab. And of course, Twitter.com/MacObserver is for everything having to do with MacObserver.com. We would love to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast. He's the one that converts this show and all the other episodes into AAC for you. That was weird. We had a little audio hiccup. Unlike anything I'd ever heard before, we would also like to thank Cashfly.com for providing all the bandwidth. And lastly, but not leastly, thanking all of our sponsors, including Audio Engine with their A2 desktop speakers, Barebones with BB in it, Smile with Text Expander, Gazelle, and yes, I am going to Blog World Expo, and you can go too, folks. You can get 50% off. I'm speaking there on Friday the 4th, I believe, of November. So come on out. 50% off using the code OBSERVER50, and all of that through Backbeat Media. So. Thanks a lot, folks. We are out of here, and I'm off to stitch this together so you can hear the show seamlessly after that crazy little audio hiccup. So lots of fun today, folks, and thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. I really do appreciate it.
You're going to be in L.A., huh?
Yeah, I'm breaking my record. I have lived low these 40 years without ever having gone to
really?
L.A.
Really?
Yeah.
I've been there.
It is what it is. But it'll be fun. Have a good week, folks. Don't get caught.